Hello and welcome to another episode of Fool's Daily. I still have my special guest, Gav Thorpe, here.
Hello.
Can't get rid of him.
No, I will keep talking and talking until you kill me. No.
Well, I hope it doesn't have to get that bad. So, we sort of touched on what we're going to talk about today the last time we spoke, which is Crown of Blood and dealing with fans and the interactions with them and things like that. So, for me, Crown of Blood was really the first work of yours that I'd read in depth, because I've said it before in the show, I'm not a massive Black Library fan, other than Gottschalk and Felix, which I have a soft spot for.
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you make... I mean, we talked about it, that Mark had approached you, but had the idea for the trilogy been bubbling in your head for a while, or was it something that when Mark said, do you want to write something, that you went away and thought, you know, I could do a trilogy?
I think it was one of the things Mark said to me really was that he'd like me to consider something that was more epic fantasy. That, you know, the Angry Robot were trying to do a lot of very new contemporary style fantasies and horror-esque stories and sci-fi and things. But actually, he did want early on in their release schedule, not necessarily a typical fantasy, because it's not that at all, but something which was just a nice big epic fantasy over three books, sort of that would tickle that itch. I'm not quite sure. Scratch that itch for their readers or for potential readers, because then, a bit like when I started with the Black Library, Angry Robot were just starting up, so there was a lot of excitement about it, but also they were trying to attract as many different types of readers to the imprint as possible at that stage. So with that in mind, and because I'd just finished writing Malekith, I suppose I didn't want to stray too far away from something with a military kind of bent to it, and something that was a kind of an epic fantasy. That's where my head was at. I wasn't going to launch myself into some, you know, Moorcock-esque, strange, you know, vision journey through something or other that I wasn't comfortable writing. I may still do some more out there. In fact, I'm hoping to write some more out there sort of fantasy and things. But this was, I wanted to write an epic fantasy, which was very different from what I was writing for Warhammer, but wasn't so different that I'd potentially scare myself and not be able to write it. So, yeah, I suppose, but the characters and this kind of the setting itself was something that had been bubbling around for a while. I'd been reading quite a lot of, I'd written a biography of Alexander, and I'd been reading quite a bit about Caesar, and sort of like the formation of that period of Roman history and things. So that all kind of bubbled into this kind of very different sort of sword and sandal setting. I wanted to get away from knights and castles and all that stuff and do something that was different in terms of technology, in terms of the basic imagery was very different from what you'd see in a lot of fantasy epics before then.
Okay. And it was always planned to be a trilogy, yeah?
Well, it was the original contract was three books with an option for a fourth. But so by the time we got to book two, there was sort of like a tacit understanding that this would be a trilogy, which would then get bound up into an omnibus. So when I first started planning the series, there was a potential that there would be a bit more of a, I wouldn't say padded, but there would be more, I suppose, a more intricate and more subplots in the middle section, I guess, which would have become the middle two books. But I think, so by the time I came to sort of planning this, we'd seen the release of the first novel and where things were going, and we're planning the second one, and by the time it came to writing the second book, we were kind of pretty much agreed that it would be three books rather than four. So, but that was, it was always going to be a series. It was always commissioned as at least three books.
Okay. And so you talked last time that you plan quite a lot before you start to put fingers to keyboard.
Yeah.
Do you, when you're planning something like the Crown Trilogy, do you have for your major characters, do you know how they're going to progress through all the books, or do you adjust how they're going to be based on feedback? You know, say you publish the first book, do you adjust how they're going to be based on feedback, or is it, this is the arc of the story, this is the arc of the characters, this is how they're going to progress?
There's sort of two different things there, I suppose. The arc of the story didn't change very much, as I say, because I always start with an ending and work my way back. And almost the third book was almost kind of written in my head before I got anywhere near to writing it, because by the time I'd written the first two books, they were just the character arcs and the plots had to go somewhere, and I'd already worked out where they were going, and that pretty much filled up book three. But the presentation of it, how much time you spend with particular characters, or I suppose whether you highlight certain secondary characters a bit more or let them drop away, that can change on feedback. So, and I did. I mean, there was one of the criticisms levelled at the first book was the lack of female characters. And it wasn't a deliberate kind of choice I knew that the female characters were going to become more prominent as the series progressed because I knew where the story was going. But actually, in the second and third book, I made more of an effort to make sure I gave them more screen time. So although their importance didn't necessarily change, the way I showed their importance did. And similar with a couple of the other characters, secondary characters, just making, you know, it was obvious that one particular character, Angolan, really wasn't very popular. He wasn't meant to be popular. He was meant to be a bit of a scapegoat in some regards but I just kind of pushed it more, I suppose. I made him even more of a cretin, I suppose. Even more self-serving and things, and that kind of worked out. Highlighted, I didn't want him becoming a caricature, but that, you know, he went from being a slightly ambiguous character to being an out and out antagonist, and that wasn't necessarily planned from the start.
Okay.
And then, yeah, I suppose as I was writing it, certain characters develop. But one of the things about the Crown of the Blood, and it was kind of a conceit of mine, which is there's an opening prologue in an ancient temple, and there's almost like an almost prophecy is made, which pretty much does tell everybody what's going to, in a few lines, tells everybody what's going to happen in the series. But of course, nobody knew that when they started reading it. But actually, if you've read the trilogy and you look back at those opening lines, it tells you what's going to happen.
You write that, it gets published. It's very well received, from what I can make out. I certainly enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, I was very. It was, again, sort of the difference between doing the Black Library and something like that. Obviously, there's still people who are going to review it and things, but actually, it was all my own work. You know, people as a tie-in writer, you've always got that slight undercurrent of, would people buy this if it didn't have Warhammer 40k on the front? And the truth is, they would. You have to have that confidence as a writer. But doing purely an original trilogy or an original book when the first one came out is, it's all my work. If people don't like the world, it's my fault. If people don't like the characters, it's my fault. If people don't like the plot, it's my fault. There's nobody else I can point at to say, well, I had to do it because that was what was already written, or, well, if you don't like 40k, then you're never going to like a 40k book. It was all my own. And when the first kind of review came in, and it was a good response, you know, a good reaction, and more sort of reviews came in and people liked it, it was a sense of, I was really pleased with that. And I suppose part of the pressure I'd put on myself was, you know, it's quite often said that old tie-in writers write tie-in fiction because they wouldn't be able to write anything else. And it's just not true. They wouldn't, you know, or they wouldn't get published if they were trying to write their own stuff. So there was a lot of pressure that I'd heaped on myself, almost representing Black Library authors, but also tie-in fiction authors, saying, no, we choose to write in those other universes because we enjoy it, and, you know, there's good commercial reasons, but, you know, here's a story that I've written, and I've just put as much effort into here as I would any other novel. I just happen to be creating my own world. So it was gratifying that it was well received.
And Do you keep your reviews? Do you have a file?
Oh, no.
I suppose these days they're all electronic.
So I know where the good ones are. When you're having one of those down moments, and somebody's, you know, and you're thinking, why do I bother? And somebody's just been giving you a kick in, then, you know, sometimes it's nice to pull out one of those nice five-star ones and buck yourself up. But you should, you know, you can't take the extremes too seriously. And actually, it's the detail, I suppose, and people picking up on certain points is quite gratifying. When people, you know, it's the same, I suppose, as talking to fans, you know, when they say, oh, yeah, I really liked what you did with X, and you intended to do that with X. You just go, great, I got my, you know, I got across what I wanted to do, or a theme, or whatever it might be. So it's the same with reviews, I suppose. As a writer, you want other people to get it, to understand what you were trying to do. And even if necessarily they don't like the delivery or particular things, if they understand maybe the themes or whatever it might be, then it gives you that confidence boost, I suppose, to know that you're obviously not completely terrible at what you do. And some people like it. And then it sort of like fuels you to keep going, really.
And do the good reviews help explain to your family what you actually do for a living?
Well, I mean, fortunately, they're fans as well. I mean, particularly my mum and my brother sort of read fantasy and science fiction anyway. So, and not so much these days, but, you know, the first science fiction books I read were probably from my dad's bookshelf. So, you know, it's easier explaining when you're an author, I can tell you, than explaining that you're a games developer for toy soldiers. Say you're a games developer, people automatically assume video games. And then you have to get into, well, it's a company called Games Workshop, and they make these little figures. And it gets like, whereas if you just say, I write science fiction and fantasy novels, whether people think that's a bit weird or not, they understand what you do. So actually, yeah, becoming an author has made it easier to explain what I do to people rather than more difficult.
So, and I mean, you touched on it yesterday and just now. I mean, dealing with fans, I mean, it must be weird dealing with people who have devoured something that you've put so much time into and maybe have completely different interpretations of how things work than you do. I mean, I was reminded of the scene in Galaxy Quest where the fans are trying to talk to the actors and they're going, what about in this episode? And they're going, no, it's just a story.
Yeah.
It's not real. Do you have fans? I mean, do people come to you and say, well, in so on page 54 of so-and-so?
Oh, yeah, utterly. I mean, Galaxy Quest is one of my favourite films because of it's got that sense perfect. Because as a games developer, as a writer, you're invested in what you do. But you have a professional relationship with it as well. And so I love 40K, and I'd say I have been since, you know, 1987 when I first got Rogue Trader or whatever. I've been really invested in it and things. But as a games developer, I understood I was behind the curtain, you know, moving the levers and things, and the reality of what it is and the construction of it is more evident, I suppose. So when you've got somebody who's treating it almost like a reality, like, you know, it's like, well, this thing doesn't quite make sense. You go, well, that's because one guy made that up 10 years ago and I made that thing up 1 year ago and I didn't read what that other guy wrote because I didn't see it because it was in some obscure white dwarf. Sorry, it's all made up. But you can't necessarily say it's all made up. There's a certain type of fan, I suppose, that demands continuity, demands it to be correct. Just as certain fans who demand, you know, have other demands of it, whether it's, you know, a style or a narrative sort of thing. So you try your best. That's all you can do. But also, you can't write to one particular section of the fan base. You know, if nothing changed, if there was never a chance to reinvent anything or do an idea better, then if you look back, particularly 40K, but also Warhammer, if you look back over the history, if nothing had evolved, there'd be some really rubbish stuff in there. Because sometimes better ideas come along and new interpretations improve on what was done before, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, the sheer continuity fact of it, of, you know, Black Library releases 3 novels a month or whatever it is, there's how many codexes and supplements come out. You can't keep abreast of all of it. What you have to do is hope that the editors have a better idea, I suppose, of where certain things are, where you can look. But then there's the flip side of it, which is sometimes as a creator, you do deliberately drop in references to an old thing or you know, stuff that's kind of not necessarily part of the main range anymore or whatever. And those same fans will see that and recognise that and go, aha, yeah, I see what you did there. You made a reference to that obscure article, and that's when you feel good. So, you know, there's the unintentional sort of when you miss it, but when you intend it and somebody notices it, that's very, that's as much part of the fun, I suppose, is like little in-jokes or I suppose intertextual references is how you do it if you're being fancy about it. You depend on that, those kinds of very serious fans understanding that and taking enjoyment from that as well.
Cool. Do you find that you take criticism about the Crown series more personally because it's your world?
Maybe. I don't think so. I mean, I think the one criticism that really kind of bugs me a little bit is when people are overly literal, either one way or another. So with the Crown series, one of the things is people saying, or is either just saying, oh, it's just Rome, a fantasy version of Rome, which was my pitch. It was a fantasy version of HBO's Rome, the series, but I went beyond that. Or people will say, oh, it's like Rome, but he's got it wrong. And the point is, it's neither of those things. It's a whole mixture of sort of the Roman Empire, Alexander's Persian conquest and all this kind of thing. So it's not meant to be one or the other. It's a fantasy construct of both. So in terms of the world, that's the bit that bugs me, is you haven't quite understood what... Obviously, I didn't necessarily portray what I wanted to do quite the way I wanted it. So criticism, the criticism that gets you the most is the one that's right. I suppose it's easy to... The raving maniacs who are like, one star, blah, blah, can't write for, you know, Toffee, they're quite easy to ignore, actually, because it's clearly not true. Even in my darkest moments of, you know, judging myself as a worthless artist and things, obviously enough people have said to me, I've enjoyed your books, that I know that I can, for some people at least, write. So, and similarly, the other end, when it's just gushing praise without any analysis, it's nice to have, but you can't, that's not feedback. You can't take it on board and improve with it. And so, just like editorial feedback and years of working as a part of a team and a design process has taught me that feedback's good. And then there's establishing your filter is what's important, so that you understand what's just criticism and what's constructive criticism, and similarly what's just praise and what's constructive praise. So, you know, do less of that, do more of that, and that's how you improve. And people who can convey that in a civilised, well-constructed way will find themselves more useful to their to, you know, their reviews or their criticisms more useful than people who just rant. Because ranting, just as somebody shouting you in the street or whatever, it's easy to ignore them, you know, or you try to. Whereas actually if somebody's having a conversation with you and is willing to listen to you but also offer their opinion, then you've got a dialogue and that's where something good can happen. And I suppose I just went through enough years of people outside the process making judgments on the end product and me knowing the decisions that went into those, sometimes having an ability to explain those decisions. A lot of the time, because it's part of an internal process, you can't say, well, actually, I didn't decide that. But you have to take the rough with the smooth, and that kind of, I suppose, you develop that thick skin then.
Yeah. So what are you working on at the moment?
Well, literally at the moment, I'm writing a Blood Angels short story, which I have no idea when that's going to come out. The main things, I suppose, I've got, in terms of releases, I have Master of Sanctity, which is the second book in my Dark Angels trilogy, comes out this summer, I think in June. And that's exciting, actually. I think that's going to, if there's Dark Angels fans, they're going to have their heads, little heads blown up a little bit by what happens in that.
Oh, no, you mustn't do that.
And then book three is just going to go, poof. It's great. I mean, if I threw a big stick in the pond with Angels of Darkness, then hopefully book two, Master of Sanctity, and certainly book three is just going to basically kick the water out in everybody's faces and just go, sort it out for yourselves. So that's, I'm looking forward to that, actually. I think there's a few copies on sale at Adepticon. So there's a couple of those getting out there now already. I've not actually got my copy yet, but you know, that's another issue. And I say I've got Doom of Dragonback as a one-off Dwarfs Time of Legends novel, which I had immense fun writing, just because I love Warhammer Dwarfs, and that's been, you know, my army for, and the part of the background I've liked the most for a long, long time. So it was just, I've not written anything with them in, or certainly not as main characters, for a long, long time. So that kind of, that just flowed. That was quite a, it's a long novel. It's 120,000 words, but it only took me about 6 weeks to write the first draft.
Oh, wow.
Because I was just so, you talk about that comfortable pair of shoes, you know,
yeah,
into it. That, you know, the dwarves are that, they've not changed that dramatically. And so just, I'm just steeped in the dwarves enough that I can just write as them and different characters without too much effort. So that was, and just enjoyed the process immensely. And then, as I say, I've been trying to do a bit of games design work with my friend Carl, which might be coming out. That's up to him. I'm just an advisor and playtester. And also, I've been doing some game, some sort of video games concept work and things, but that's, none of that's been announced yet. So that was a big chunk of what.
So no more. So, you know, Gav Thorpe,
well,
own brand.
Yeah,
novels.
I've been working on something. Well, I've been working on various things, but I've been working on a new sort of setting, a new novel series that I hope to get the first novel. There's no deals lined up for it yet, but I hope to get the first novel finished later this year. I've got about 2/3 of it done now in between commissioned work. I gave myself October and November off commissioned work last year just to work on getting my own stuff. That's the problem, is that, you know, once you, I don't want to call it a treadmill because that sounds arduous, but once you get into the rhythm of writing commissioned work and having releases all scheduled and things, it's very hard to create a break, because what you're doing is taking something that's a sure thing, something that people are going to pay you for, something more speculative. So this is very much a speculative thing, just to do my own. It's quite, I keep referring to it as spellpunk, just because that's a ridiculous way of referring to a fantasy series. But it's very fantasy in terms of, it's quite a small setting, but there's a lot of, it's a confluence of different worlds, so there's lots of different creatures around, and it's not just about, in fact, the main character isn't even human. It's like she's an inhuman assassin, and there's a big thing, and she ends up kind of at odds with the equivalent of what the Assassin's Guild is, and there's a priest, and also all kinds of other stuff. And it's just the setup, really, for this place, the city of the city of Eternal Dawn, I think that's called, which is, I say, it's quite different. I've talked previously about, you know, writing trilogies and series and knowing what the end is. Well, I'm approaching this very much from this is a one-off novel, but actually I've created the setting in a way that I could tell as many stories there as I want. It's a new way of writing for me. So that's quite exciting. I could see myself coming back to this setting again and again, should people want to buy it, and either with the same characters or different characters in the same place, being able to tell a dozen different stories, and not, it's driven by that setting, that the setting's been driven by world creation and kind of going back to somewhere I'd like to write stories rather than a single narrative, which is what happens with most of my series.
Oh, wow.
So, but yeah, I mean, I need to tout that to agents and editors and see.
So this would be your first one that you actually went that sort of cap in hand route rather than.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. This is, I've got this book. Would you like to either represent it or buy it as part of an ongoing series? As opposed to, I've already had a nod and a wink beforehand that it was designed.
Yeah. Oh, so that's another big step for you then that way.
I mean, it's one that I suppose I can do because I've got that surety. I've got that commissioned work coming in and various other projects on the go. This isn't a be all and end all of whether, you know, it's not going to make or break whether I paid a mortgage in 6 months' time. But which allows me to have some freedom with it, and also to spend some time on it, making sure it's right, you know. Before I get to send it off to somebody, but yeah, I suppose there's always the risk that nobody's going to like it or want it. It's not even necessarily like, but whether people will think it's fit or whether it's what the market's ready for. It's got a much more swords and sorcery feel to it. It's quite, I wouldn't say light-hearted, because it's not light-hearted, but there's a kind of sense of a bit of a moving fantasy. There's a lot of what's been, you know, termed grimdark, and lots of big overbearing epics, and it's the Game of Thrones effect as well. You know, this is a very different kind of storytelling. It's heavy on the fantasy elements. It's fun. It's a more kind of Conan, more kind of Fritz Lieber approach to world building. You know, if I need something in there, then it's in there because it's cool. It's got all kinds of weird and wonderful races and magic and stuff like that. So, and like I said, and deliberately open-ended, so I can continue to add things to it and create new stories around the basic ideas in the first novel. So, actually, nobody's interested. In which case, I'll cry.
I'm holding my hand up because it sounds right up my street. Right.
Well, when it's good, you can be one of my test readers. You know.
I'm there because that's the Fritz Lieber and things like that. That's my sort of fantasy these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think and talking to other people, there's some younger authors who are being published at the moment as well. There is a move back to that sword and sorcery vibe. I think ebooks and novellas and stuff are making a bit, and short stories are making more of a comeback now. So that sort of slightly more pulp approach of creating stories, which then sort of map out a world rather than huge world building exercise in which you then set stories. There's more of an exploration and more fun and just slightly, I suppose it's, the real world's grim dark enough as it is at the moment. So something a bit more exotic and fantastical. I think people are appreciating that sort of writing a bit more at the moment.
And you haven't signed your HBO deal yet to have the Crown series take over from Game of Thrones?
No, but when they're ready, and I'm waiting for my letter, I'm sure it will be, as long as I can work out how to get the guys riding the giant cats.
Do you have enough nudity in it? That's really the question.
Again, it's one of those things that very different in approach to the Black Library. Black Library kind of is a PG-13 sort of approach, so you can have naughty bits, but the door kind of closes. Violence is fine, obviously, and swearing minimal, if any. Whereas the Crown of the Blood is adult. It's got sex scenes. It's got some fantastic swearing in it, and it was part of that. It's to appeal to that Game of Thrones HBO market. It was part of the, I suppose, part of the genesis of it was not necessarily it would be made into a TV series, although that'd be nice. But yeah. that approach and that sentiment, I suppose, would follow through in the way that it was written.
Well, we're out of time again.
No problem.
Gav, it's been fantastic to talk to you.
Great to talk to you too.
And hopefully if you ever want to come back on again, feel free.
Oh, because yes.
It's been great. So for the last time, I've been Mike.
And I've been Gav.
And speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
You can contact Fools Daily on Twitter, we're @fools_daily, or via email, foolsdaily@outlook.com.